This copyrighted podcast is presented by the U.S. Highbush Blueberry Council. The opinions and views shared by those of non-paid guests on the business of blueberries are those of our guests and do not represent the views, positions, or policies of the USHBC. The blueberry industry is like no other. Passionate, resilient, and innovative. This podcast is your source for the latest information on the management, markets, research, and technology related to blueberry production. This is the business of blueberries. Here's your host, President of the U.S. Highbush Blueberry Council, Casey Cronquist.
Welcome back to another episode of The Business of Blueberries, the only podcast dedicated exclusively to the blueberry industry. And we have an exciting episode for you today featuring someone who has been a leader in blueberries for a long time, David Jackson. In 2001, David founded Family Tree Farms alongside his son and son-in-law, and the four of them launched the company with one goal in mind: consistently produce, package, and market the most flavorful fruit in the world. Today, they remain a family-owned grower, packer, and shipper of fruit based in Reedley, California, with other locations in Peru, Mexico, and Africa. David also serves on the NABC Board of Directors, as well as the United Blueberry Advisory Committee, and a signatory of the MOU. I've been looking forward to getting together with David on this podcast for a long time to get his perspective on quality, flavor, genetics, marketing, and the future of our industry. David, thank you for joining me on The Business of Blueberries.
It's great to be with you, Casey.
Well, I've had the privilege to get to know you over my tenure here at the councils, but I would like to have this opportunity to introduce you, or I'd like the audience to have the opportunity to get to know you a little bit better. So I thought we'd start off with just how you became a farmer, David. What life experience drew you into this profession, this industry we know as agriculture?
Well, I tell you, since I was a boy following my father in the fields, I've really always just wanted to be a farmer, and I've always had projects. My dad let me have different projects in the field and growing pigs and this and that. And in FFA, well, I had all the projects, and I guess, let's see, in 1966 to the present, I've grown and changed different crops, actually six different major crops: turkeys, field crops, vegetables, table grapes, stone fruit, blueberries, and really all of them on a pretty large scale in their time. And I changed these major crops from time to time just because of shrinking margins. And I have to tell you that one time, I don't know what I was saying to my five-year-old grandson over in the seat of the truck, and he looked up at me and says, "Grandpa, things change." And I said, "Wow," from the mouth of babes. I've always wanted to be a leader and not a follower. And there's an old saying, you're either making dust or eating dust, right? So I've always kind of wanted to make dust. And from the world's view, I guess I've been fairly successful in adapting to that. But in the 80s, when the interest rates went to 18%, and I, like many other farmers in America, we just had what I call the opportunity to start over again in America. And to start over, I mean, I sold everything I owned except my home, and I paid back everybody that I owed. My wife, Gail, and I have been blessed with 21 grandchildren and 31 great-grandchildren, and I hope that through that there's many more farmers to come, Lord willing. But my sons and my son-in-law and I started Family Tree Farms, like you said earlier, about 25 years ago. And now my grandsons are heavily involved in the business. In fact, that five-year-old grandson I talked about earlier, Wade, he's 33 years old now and is heavily involved in our blueberry program. And like you mentioned earlier, and I just have to say it because that's who Family Tree Farms is, our mission statement is to consistently produce, package, and market the most flavorful fruit in the world. And we say that because we know who we sell to. But we always keep in mind that our end customer is that consumer, that person that puts that fruit in their mouth and says, "Wow, that's the most flavorful thing. That's the best thing I've ever eaten." And we have chosen to differentiate ourselves with flavor, and that comes down to just genetics. And we've been blessed to have the MBO genetics from the Rindley Bell in Australia, who is really the standard for the industry worldwide.
Well, so I want to just take a moment there to kind of talk a little bit about, you know, the background, but where Family Tree is today in relationship to Blueberry. So, you know, it was Family Tree Farms, and you were talking about stone fruit and a lot of trees that are involved with that. Now you're in the blueberry business. So help us understand the transition or the evolution as it is to where you're at with blueberries, and what part of the business is blueberries to Family Tree Farms today?
I think when the most flavorful fruit in the world, it transitioned. Actually, my son and I were in Spain looking for stone fruit, and we visited a blueberry farm there in Spain. And one thing led to another, and we really got the MBO genetics from that position. And it all revolves around the most flavorful fruit in the world. And really, I think our growth in blueberries and our success really depends on providing that feel-good, fantastic, I don't know, wow eating experience that consumers have when they eat blueberries. So, you know, the family business has really grown, and we've expanded. Actually, Family Tree Farms is bigger in blueberries now than we are in stone fruit, and we're known around the world for our stone fruit also.
And for you, it began in Reedley, California. So the stone fruit business and the blueberry business all began for you there in California. But you've obviously expanded since then. But, you know, when did you guys jump into blueberries, you know, relatively speaking? And then I'd like to talk a little bit more about the other productions regions you have in other countries.
Sure. Yeah, well, we started about 20 years ago. We farm in Tulare County in the San Joaquin Valley, and about an hour's drive away are the foothills of Kettleman. And we can usually grow crops up there, the same varieties, and they'll come off a week to 10 days, 15 days earlier because they get more sunlight and more heat. So we went up to Kettleman and started our first blueberry production up there, of course, to come in earlier. And that was our first forte into it. And then when we got the MBO genetics, well, we started looking at other countries that, you know, we can talk about later. But the family business and family farms, it's really challenging to be a farmer anywhere in the world. It's just a challenging business. And we have high capital requirements. We have access to higher markets. We need constant battle to make enough profit to stay in business. And years ago, Casey, I was asked to go to a university and lecture on how does a young person get started in production agriculture. And I really believe now the topic of the day should be is how does a family survive in changing world of economics where, you know, logistic products can be supplied 52 weeks out of the year. In a family farm only supplies 6 weeks of those 52 weeks. And really, family business, and I'm talking about this because I really feel that farmers are the backbone of all of this industry. And I also see that there's hedge funds and large amounts of money pouring into agriculture and just competes with the family farmer. And my answer to that is kind of what my father always had a saying, nothing grows well unless your shadow's on the soil. And there's nothing like a farmer whose family's livelihood depends on a crop. They know long hours and they know physical and mental work. They've persevered through adversity and, I don't know, they've been humbled by elements, but their shadow stays on the soil all the time. And I believe that the family farmer is the forgotten individual in these large capital funds that we see coming in. And that farmer's shadow on the soil is the difference between, I don't know, success and failure. And farmers are the heroes of food production. So I don't know if I can slip that in or not, but I'm just real adamant about family farms.
Well, I'm glad you did, because I think that's part of what makes your journey in this business so fascinating for others to both be be aware of, but for those who are listening and getting to know you through this podcast for the first time, it's a good segue into, you know, you're in Mexico yourself today, I believe, and you have a farm in Mexico today, and you made a decision at some point to begin farming in Mexico, a grower in California. And I just thought we could spend a little time on that decision point for you and you as a family to take family tree to Mexico, to be a farmer there in Mexico. And then, of course, the time and the effort, you know, to, you know, cast your shadow there in relationship to, you know, the farm that you were used to farming there in California. I mean, talk about that journey. What was that decision point? What made you as a family finally make the decision, you know, we're going to start farming in Mexico?
Yeah, well, you know, my father has a saying. I'm saying a lot of my father's sayings, but my father used to tell me, if you think it's greener on the other side of the fence, you better put on a little more fertilizer and put on a little more water. Because where you live in the San Joaquin Valley of California, you produce more agricultural products than all but five states in the union. And we can grow 342 different crops, and we are the leader in the nation in 48 of those. So you say, why Mexico? Why would you leave if you're a farmer? Why do you leave the most productive agricultural area in the world? And all that's true. But unfortunately, our California government's making it very difficult for us to, to sustain a profitable farming operation. So now I don't know what my dad would say, but I have to start looking on the other side of the fence. So 15, 20 years ago, I looked at the North American and South American blueberry production curve for 52 weeks. And on that curve, and this was a while ago, but on that curve, I saw that December through February, there was Chile kind of had good production. And then February through April, May, Mexico kind of had low production there. But then in May through September, North America spiked a big mountain right through that whole time. And it was very heavy. And then September through November, Peru kind of had a low production time. So really, when you look at that and you map it out, you see the big spike and you see Mexico on one shoulder and you see Peru on the other shoulder. And actually, at that time, Peru had the lowest production and it looked like it had the biggest valley to fill. So really, when somebody looks at that, which I did, it's a matter of supply and demand. I mean, where do you go to get a supply when there's the highest demand, not the lowest demand? So I had the genetics, and Mexico was the closest, and I had an association with a man I'd been associated with for 20 years that was farming in Mexico. And I called him and said, hey, you want to grow blueberries with me in Mexico? And he said, okay. And that's been our partner ever since. It's worked out really well for us. Mexico has a great agricultural infrastructure, but I found that, I don't know, anything you build, plant, or buy in Mexico is really just as expensive or more expensive than in the USA. And the only thing that's I found cheaper is food and hourly wages. And that's kind of something that people talk about. But in fact, the hourly wages in Mexico, they're really increased by the lower production of their performance. So really, all things wash pretty closely here in Mexico. But we've been very thankful for the opportunity to be here.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, is it a goal on Family Tree's part to provide blueberries 52 weeks out of the year? Or I'm still going back to that decision point where, you know, the catalyst of the moment to say, you know, you saw an opportunity, yes, the grass looked like it could be greener over there, yes. But it was still not a small decision to make to decide to start investing in Mexico. And there's lots of folks, you know, who probably saw those same data points. But you made the decision to do it. And, you know, I guess I'm digging a little bit deeper there with you, David, trying to understand, like, what was it like when you finally decided, we got to do this? You know, it's important. For what reason? What purpose? What, I mean, yes, the data, yes, you saw the valleys, you saw an opportunity in supply, but to leave California to go to Mexico to start production, and I take it it's the first crop you've grown in another country, is that fair?
First and only crop, yeah, it's the only crop we've grown. I think the answer to that question, you know, I said it early, in all of our hearts, we have different attitudes, and mine's a make dust or you eat dust. And, you know, if we were going to be successful with the genetics that I had in my toolbox, I was going to have to go someplace to where we could get the largest return out of it. And really, it's just a 12-hour truck ride from California. So that was quite an easy choice. Now, I'm not saying that Mexico is an easy place to be, and everybody knows that there's many problems here, but I'm thankful for my partner. If it was just I by myself, I know that I would not have made it. But we didn't come to Mexico with the grand idea that we're going to produce 52 weeks out of the year. I saw an opportunity, and I wanted to fill that opportunity. After we filled that opportunity and got going, we said, you know what? What about that other shoulder? How about Peru? What's going on there? And we went over, and what we found was that Peru has tremendous potential. It has a 6-to-month producing timeline. There's no place in the world like that. And it has available land, it has water, it has labor, it has infrastructure, it has logistics. The growers are just experts in technology. So I see Family Tree Farm's greatest growth in the future being Peru. And yes, now, as we have grown, yes, we absolutely need to have our quality of blueberries 52 weeks out of the year to supply our retail partners. So we're looking very hard at that. We will have our largest increase in Peru. We'll also increase our acreage in Mexico, and we'll increase our acreage in North America. And that's all to have a 52-week supply of what we consider the most flavorful fruit in the world.
Well, I want to talk about, you know, where you see Family Tree going. I also want to talk about where you see the industry going, and certainly some of these genetics that get you excited. So I want to come back to that, but it's time for our crop report. The domestic season is just getting started this month in Florida, and we also have some reports coming in from Peru and Chile and Mexico. So here once again is your blueberry crop report.
Yes, it's time for your blueberry crop report, an update on crop conditions and markets from important blueberry growing areas. Today you'll hear from Brittany Lee in Florida, Mario Ramirez in Mexico, and Danielle Bustamante in Peru. This was recorded on March 14th, 2024.
Good morning. This is Brittany Lee with this week's Florida Crop Update. Last week, harvest was slow because of the cooler weather, but we expect a significant increase in production this week with the warmer temperatures. Disease pressure is minimal. There are very few birds at this time, not many waxwings, if any. There are some robins. Growers are reporting sufficient labor. The South Central growers are picking Arcadia, Avanti, and Kestrel. Central Florida has been picking Arcadia, Avanti, and Optimus. And growers in the North have started on Sentinel. That's your Florida crop update. Have a great week.
Hello, everyone. Here, Mario, with the Mexican Blueberry Report for week number 10, from March 3rd to March 9th. During this week, Mexico exported a total of 6,900,000 pounds of fresh blueberries worldwide. 95% of the total volume goes to United States, and the remaining 330,000 pounds were to other destinations, mainly in Europe and Asia. 18% of the total volume was organic blueberries, which is 1 million organic fresh blueberries exported mainly to United States. The total volume grows 12% respecting previous week, and it remains lower comparing to previous season for the same week with 32% less volume. This week we have no volumes of frozen blueberries reported, and the total volume for the entire season at this week is 50,800,000 pounds of fresh blueberries. That's all in my report, and see you next week. Thank you very much.
Hello, this is Daniel with a crop report from Peru until the end of week 10 that ran from March 4th to the 10th. So far, this season that started in week 18 until the current week 10, Peru has shipped a total of 487.6 million pounds of fresh blueberries to the world. That is 22% less volume than what was shipped during the same period last season. The US remains as the main destination for Peruvian blueberries, representing 55% of the total shipments so far, followed by Europe with 29%, China with 12%, and other markets accounting for the remaining 4%. Out of the total volume shipped, 10% have been organics. During week 10, blueberry shipments accounted for a total of 3.23 million pounds, that is 25% less volume than last week. The US market represented 83% of the shipped volume with 2.7 million pounds, that is 21% less volume than last week. And this volume should be arriving to the US market by the fourth week of March. The other markets where Peru shipped blueberries to this week were Europe with 8% of the volume, China with only 1% of the volume, and other destinations jumped to 8% of the volume. This has been the Peruvian Crop Report for week 10. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much to our busy growers and colleagues who take time to participate in these reports. As a reminder, you can go to the ushbc.org/data to find our Data and Insight Center to see more data about what's happening in our blueberry industry. Please join us at ushbc.org/data to check that out. Okay, now back to our conversation with David Jackson. David, we were just talking about what your favorite crop is, and I want to kind of segue now to where you see Family Tree going. But, you know, in terms of what gets you excited about this business, you know, what's remarkable about your story that we're talking about here is just the iteration, the evolution, the innovation that is involved at Family Tree in order to, you know, produce in places like Mexico and Peru and other places, South Africa, other places around the world. It's no small effort. And so I'm curious, like, what gets you excited? Like, what motivates you every day to get up and do this? I know you feel like it's a calling and, you know, it's across all the crops that you've been a part of, but what gets you excited today about blueberries? What gets you up in the morning? What's motivating you right now?
Well, I'll tell you what is exciting to me about the future of blueberries. And really it's a couple of words, Casey, and that's the health factor. We're riding the biggest horse down the produce aisle, and we can win that race. Blueberries are the healthiest fruit you can eat, and it's in demand now. It's the darling of retail. It's a holy grail of longevity food. And, you know, you go down the list, and that's what gets me excited about growing this. It strengthens your cells. It's great for eyesight. It helps your muscle recovery. It boosts your brain health. It reduces inflammation. It lowers cholesterol. It increases blood flow. It helps reduce Alzheimer's. It helps reduce sugar diabetes. It helps reduce breast cancer. I mean, you can eat them. You can snack them. You can use them in salads, in smoothies, cereals. You can frozen. You can send them to school, take them to the office. They're clean, neat, and healthy. What else do you need? What can you get more excited about blueberries and when you hear all of that?
We're gonna have to take you on the road, David. Do you play pickleball? We might need you out there on the pickleball field, you know, helping us with our next promotion.
Yeah, no, it really, it doesn't matter who you are or where you live in the world, man. Everyone wants to live a longer, healthier life. And I'll say it again, really, what gets me excited about growing blueberries, that's how healthy they are.
Yeah, well, and you know, the good news is, the USHBC and the industry has done a tremendous job on that platform, and we continue to invest, and we are continuing to help communicate a message. And yet at the same time, David, we have this group of people, a rather large group of people, who aren't eating blueberries today. And there's a lot of reasons for that that we have, you know, information on that we've been studying and understanding and trying to figure out how to unlock that next level. And so I know you talked genetics earlier, you know, as a piece of what you know. It already has the health components in it, but what is it about genetics to you that helped this industry shift gears? Or what is it about genetics that you're so passionate about that's going to help drive the future of Family Tree? Or do you think it's genetics today that are holding us back from that future consumer? Or it's just that they haven't heard the health message, you know, from a perspective of appreciation that you know it to be?
Well, first of all, genetics, like I said, it's Some people can run faster and jump higher. And if we are growing food for the consumer and not for a market to fill a space, to get there in time and everything else, but if you're actually growing a blueberry for the consumer, you want that to be the best eating experience they've had every time. And that best eating experience is a crunchy, sweet, consistently flavorful piece of fruit. And so when we talk genetics, I mean, that's what we're looking for. I mean, you're looking for heavy production, you know, 25, 30,000 pounds the acre. You want flavor, pop, size, heavy bloom. You want it sweet, mechanically harvestable. You want pest and disease resistant. And you want a strong post-harvest that it ships well and gets there. So genetics, all of those keys makes us farmers, are those people that gets food to people. If we can make that eating experience fantastic, we can absolutely increase the market and the sales for blueberries. And to your point, I believe in the blueberry industry, and I think it has great opportunity to produce its market and the share. And I'm personally a great supporter of what you're talking of, the NABC and the USBC Memorandum of Understanding, where we as growers and marketers voluntarily pay assessments so that we can provide sales and more sales in the world. You know, really, I believe that blueberry growers from the North and South America just really need to lay their differences aside and contribute to promoting and the eating of healthy blueberries around the world. I mean, I don't know, 2011, what, the consumption per blueberry pound was 1.2. And then I think I saw in 2022, that was raised to 2.3 pounds per capita. Well, hey, there's 350 million people in America now, and you put one more pound on that, and that's 350 million pounds. Can we do it a year? Can we do it in 2 years? And if you want to blow your mind, I mean, there's 8 billion people in the world. So bottom line is, we as an industry need to get together and promote the healthiest fruit in the world and increase that sale by one clamshell per person. And we won't be able to keep up with the demand. And why is that? It's because they're getting something that not only is fantastically enjoyable to eat, but it's the best thing in the world for them.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate, you know, you reflecting on data and certainly the information that I know we look at that tells us that there's this, you know, huge runway still ahead for blueberries compared to other berries, compared to other crops. I mean, we obviously, you know, point to the avocado industry. That's part of the conversation we're all in right now and trying to understand how do they get to, you know, 12 pounds per capita and also maintain the value of their crop, actually increase the value of their crop over that same period of time where supply was coming into the market. So a lot of that work, David, that still has yet to be done in trying to encourage that consuming public to consume either more or consume it for the first time is still ahead of us. You know, and I talk to people about, you know, the comparison of table grapes to blueberries. You know, table grapes have been around for human consumption for thousands of years, you know, being farmed and provided to the table. But blueberries, it's only been 100 years. I mean, we really are at still the very beginning of a crop that many people in the world either haven't seen or heard of. Here in the United States, we've been very fortunate that it began here in commercial production. And so lots of regions have been marketing and growing the supply and the demand. But a lot more, right, can be done. So I wanted to get your thoughts. I know, you know, health certainly, but what more do you see in that unification of the industry to try and drive consumers to this category that we can be doing together? What does that look like to you? What's your vision for that going forward?
Well, first of all, like you're explaining, we have a very, very exciting piece of fruit to be a part of. And that piece of fruit is going to be in the retail market 52 weeks out of the year. So wherever we farm, any of us as family farmers, whatever place in the world we farm, we're going to have a piece of that. And there's going to be a market value of that product throughout the year. And yes, it's going to be supply and demand. And yes, it's going to come from here and there, but it's going to be a world market. So we need to all face up to that. We need to all work and adapt ourselves so that we can continue as farmers to make a profit. But we need to come together, like I was saying earlier, and get involved with you and put some money in to increase the sales by the advertising. And that will help all of us, no matter what 52-week period that we are working in. It is going to be a world market. Things change. So we need to recognize that. And how can each one of us continue to bring profit to the farm? And that's adaptability. Do we need to change varieties? What technology, what kind of water, what kind of fertilizer? How do we need to cover our plants? When can we bring them in? All of those in packaging and packing and everything. So all of those things come together in adaptability for each one of us in our time slot in that 52 weeks. But we can come together as an industry and all of us pitch in for that 52 weeks out of the year to get a sustainable price so that we can all make a good living.
Well, and I've appreciated your leadership on that message. You've been a big part of kind of bringing the industry together, you know, certainly on that MOU group, but also, you know, you've made yourself available. You're part of the North American Blueberry Council board, and reiterating what you're saying here on the podcast, in the meetings that we've been in, the conversation you're willing to have with growers domestically, internationally. You were part of the delegation that went to Peru this year, and you actually invited folks to your farm. So you've been a big part of helping, you know, connect a lot of these global dots on how things are moving forward and the way the industry is changing, but at the same time, you know, helping all of us to understand just what opportunity you see and what we should be all focused on as we move forward together from here. And so as you see the blueberry industry changing, you know, what do you see in the coming years? Like, I know we're talking here specifically about, you know, wanting to see the industry come together on a vision for a much bigger, you know, marketing plan, trying to attract those consumers who aren't buying today to buying tomorrow and buying in greater quantities, and another clamshell on top of that clamshell. So what do you see in the future? What's the industry look like to you going forward from here?
Well, when I started growing blueberries, they said, even what you plant's going to ruin the market. And we've seen what Peru has done. We've seen what Mexico has done. We see they're growing in Morocco. We see they're growing in South Africa. They're growing blueberries every place in the world now. And we still haven't oversupplied the market. There's been bumps in the road. But the bottom line is what you said earlier, we have a very new product, and it's the healthiest product in the world. We need to get that word out. And bottom line to what I'm telling you is I believe in the future of blueberries. I believe that we can grow more blueberries, but it needs to be a good eating experience for the consumer every time. And if we can do that, where they enjoy it and the kids love it and say, wow, that's the best thing I ever had, and it's the healthiest thing that they can have, I'm not sure that we can grow enough of that product for people. And like I said, there's 8 billion of those folks out here in the world, and we're finding markets all over the world. We just need to expand it, get in it, and let them know how healthy it is, how good they are. And I think it's one of the most exciting crops in the world to grow right now.
I appreciate you saying that, because, you know, there's always a perspective of, you know, at some point companies, depending on the industry you're in, you know, they see the pie and they want to slice it up and get the bigger piece for them. But what I know you're saying, and I think we all understand, is that there's always a larger slice when you're growing that pie. And in this case, working together, coming together to help grow that pie for the industry, grow that market opportunity for everybody, just creates, you know, so much more opportunity for everybody within the category. And that is really exciting. And I again, appreciate the time together with you today to kind of, you know, cast that understanding from your perspective, the vision that you have on why you're bullish on this, David. And every opportunity I have to talk to you about it inspires me as well. You know, before we go, I do want to talk a little bit about jumbos. So You guys are big in the jumbo category. Jumbos have been a differentiator in blueberries. You know, jumbos also have been genetically produced in a way to, you know, be of size and flavor, and you guys have done a great job with that. But what's your opinion, David, on what's too jumbo? What makes a blueberry too big? Like, when does jumbo become too big for blueberries?
Yeah. Well, Family Tree Farms, we started the jumbos because it was a differentiating factor in blueberries. All blueberries of all sizes were put into clamshells. And when I first told my kids, I'm going to differentiate this summer, they said, what? You know, we want to put all the blueberries in. We don't want to just put the big ones in. But it was a differentiating factor. But the differentiating factor also had the flavor and the crunch with it. So, yes, we did differentiate by jumbos. But when you did get that jumbo, you said, wow, this Hummer is crisp. This Hummer is sweet. This Hummer is really good. So the jumbo not only was a big berry, but it meant to the consumer that it was worth a premium. And we've found that consumers are willing to pay a premium price for a really good eating piece of fruit. You know, I would hate to see jumbos destroyed by putting just big berries in that are mushy and maybe not too sweet and maybe sour. You know, the next step in that is, okay, we have jumbos. What do we do with those down below, that 12 to 18? How do we differentiate them? And that's what we're working on now, is how do we get that a differentiated premium product other than jumbos? How big can jumbos get? Truthfully, I think the jumbo size, because of genetics that are coming out now, is going to get larger and larger. I don't know. We might be putting little plastic forks and spoons in there. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll find that out, because as with the new varieties, they're getting bigger. And basically what's going to happen, we're going to increase the size of jumbos. Instead of an 18. We might get up, it's not a jumbo until it's a 21. I don't know. I'll tell you where it's going to go is where the consumer will continue to pay a premium price for it. And if we continue getting a great eating experience, I don't know where that's going to go. We might go to one berry, man. I don't know what it is.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate you sharing that with all of us and the work you're doing, and just being an ambassador. You bring a lot of energy. You get me excited about what we're doing here. And I know you've seen a lot of things in your time as a farmer and a grower. And so thank you again for being on the show.
Hey, let's go, man. Let's climb that blueberry mountain.
Well, I look forward to climbing that mountain with you, David. Again, I appreciate you being on the show and helping us, you know, create a world that is excited about blueberries. And so that's it for episode 165. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with more innovation, collaboration, family, and hard work right here on the Business of Blueberries.